Hello everyone, Sasha from Charity Digital here, and welcome to the Charity Digital podcast. So if you're one of our dedicated podcast listeners, you might be thinking, hang on, didn't you just post a podcast last week? Indeed we did, but it's October and that means things are getting spooky. Our Spooktober campaign this month is aimed at drawing the sector's awareness to something a little darker, a little scarier, cybersecurity. Now, we've been doing a lot on cybersecurity, especially because the charity sector has witnessed far more threats and attacks since the pandemic started. Why? Because working remotely means that we don't have the usual protection available in an office environment, and as a result, more than a quarter of charities experienced a data breach in the past year. In September, we had a webinar on how the Save the Children managed to protect themselves from high levels of cyber attacks, with Etienne Grief providing an in-depth background on the cybercrime landscape. And that's exactly what you'll be listening to today. So sit back, relax somewhat, and listen to Etienne Grief from Flow Communications give you a rundown on what you need to know when it comes to cybercrime and cyber threats. Please bear in mind that this recording does come from a webinar, so there may be some references to imagery or visual prompts that are not available in this podcast format. If you're interested in the webinar, there is the full version on our website or on our YouTube channel, so feel free to have a little look. Enjoy.
I do want to start off by looking at some terminology, because I think in our industry, very often people use terminology loose and fast, and it helps to be specific at times. Then I do want to look at some elements of the cybercrime ecosystem, just to understand how that all works together, because ultimately, once we understand that, it perhaps puts us in a better position to defend ourselves. Now, of course, as most law enforcement people will tell you, if you want to really, really get to the bottom of crime and stop crime, follow the money. And I think it's also important to understand what people's motivations are, how they make money, and what the rewards are for the different forms of activity. So I do look at that, the money element of cybercrime too. And then, of course, I will conclude, you know, because I think it's always dangerous to just talk about the bad stuff, talk about how difficult it is and how much money's been made without actually saying, this is what I think this means and this is what I think you can do to protect yourself. Okay, so let's start off with some terminology. Now, very often the internet is described as an iceberg, you know, where a lot of it is visible. But actually, there's a bigger part of it that's not visible. The first part that we all are very aware of and we use all the time is the normal internet that you access using browsers like Google and Microsoft Edge, Netscape, other browsers exist, Safari, so forth. And that's searchable, that's indexable, so you can search for information. Below that, and actually a much, much bigger part of it, 80% of the internet is something called the deep web. Now, the deep web isn't very different to the internet. All it means is behind a portal of some description where you have to put in a username, a password. So it doesn't come up on the search engines, and you need to know where you want to go to, and then of course have credentials to go into this forum. And then lastly, we have the dark web. And traditionally, when you talk about the dark web, you have to lower your voice, the dark web, because this is where really, really criminal things go on. This is not specifically as indexable, searchable, and almost certainly you can't use a normal browser to access. And I'll talk about that a little bit. What I would say now, before I get into the rest of my presentation, I often feel that the whole concept of the dark web is overblown. It's overhyped. It's often used to, you know, in this fear, uncertainty, and doubt scenario. Most of the nefarious activity that goes on is on the deep web. It's on the normal internet, you know. It's simpler, it's easier, and it's the technology is much more friendly for nefarious needs. But I'll describe that and go into a bit more detail. So first of all, if I talk about the dark web here, I interchangeably mean the dark web and the deep web. While the deep and dark web may be unregulated and unstructured, you know, and like the Wild West, the activities that carry on within these areas are certainly not unstructured. They're extremely structured. They're very specific. And they are actually like set up like a business, you know. They have a business model. You know, if I look at a lot of the forums and we spend our time trying to understand what goes on within these parts of the internet, it's run like a business, you know. The people transacting on the deep web or on the dark web have chief revenue officers. They've got VPs of customer success. They have help desk people. They've got rating systems. You know, they actually want to make sure that this is productive for the activity. So, you know, there's some interesting things about this area where people will transact, and I'll talk about what gets transacted later. But an interesting thing is like an escrow service, you know, because there's no honor amongst thieves. So how do I make sure that if I transact with somebody I don't know, I don't trust, I get the service I need? So let's say I've developed a new exploit that exploits a vulnerability that's not known, a zero day, so to speak. Okay. Now this zero day is worth a lot of money. Now, of course, I want to get a lot of money for this, but the minute that I give the exploit to the person buying it, they don't need to give me the money anymore because they've got the exploit. And conversely, the person buying this exploit, if he gives me money first and I give him a duff exploit that doesn't work, he's out of pocket. And this is a deep web and nobody knows who's anybody else. So that's kind of difficult. So what you have is you have escrow brokers. And how this works is that you deposit your money with the escrow agent. The person selling the exploit gives the exploit to the escrow agent. The escrow agent will verify that it works. And only once they verify that it works and they verify that the money is legit, well, not legit, but the money is there, it's real, it's available. They'll then send the money to the exploit developer and send the exploit to the person that bought it. So a very sophisticated business model that works very, very well. Now, of course, it's very well protected from outside and law enforcement agencies because people do not want law enforcement or security companies to be part of these forums. And how do they do it? They do it via introductions, like the best clubs in the world. They do it by using cultural references that isn't easily understood outside the area where you might be using this. And they might very often charge a vetting fee or entrance fee to get part of this because they know that that's quite difficult for law enforcement to do. And a lot of it is in Russian and other languages that maybe aren't as well understood in the traditional West. So very structured, very specific, and actually run like a business. Now, the thing that we often hear about when we think about the dark web is this thing called Tor, the onion router, you know, which is a piece of software which allows you to surf stuff anonymously. Now, first of all, the first thing to say is that this was developed for legitimate purposes. The American Navy developed Tor. So when they were in theater and they wanted to research something or search for something, they didn't want the local internet service providers controlled by local governments to see what they were surfing, what they were looking at. So they created this thing called Tor. Now, Tor is used to access the dark web, but actually also really importantly, Tor is also used to access the normal web. So it's really just an anonymizing piece of software which allows you to access that unindexable part of the internet or the indexable or the deep web part of the internet. So it's just a tool, you know, the Tor in its own right, you know, it's not the dark web, it's just a mechanism to get to the normal internet or to the deep or dark web. And now, of course, when we think about the dark web and deep web, what we often focus on is this whole threat, you know, the people talk about people buying Hitman on the dark web or, you know, 3D printed plastic guns, you know, that will go through metal detectors without, you know, being picked up. And the reality is, those are mostly stings, to be honest. And also, you know, hackers are bullies very often. You know, they love attracting people into these forums on the dark web, on not so well disguised areas of the dark web, which is known, and to sell them stuff, sell them an exploit that they can use to spy on somebody. And actually, this exploit is something to hack the noob, as they call them, newbie. So I think, you know, one has to be quite careful in terms of how one differentiates between the hype and the stuff that's actually real, that's monetizable, which I'll get onto next. So as I said already, you know, cybercrime operations nowadays are organized like normal business. You know, they have structures, they have specializations, you know, like in business, you know, the accountant doesn't do law, doesn't do sales, doesn't do everything. In the cybercrime operations have now become very, very specialized. You have people that look after developing exploits. You have people that sell access to systems. You have people that help you deliver that exploit. You know, in other words, craft the phishing emails. You have people that actually brings it all together, like the hackers will actually use these different techniques to do it. You have the people that will control different devices once they've been compromised and will sell that access to, let's say, a ransomware gang that's looking for a particular sector like the charity. So they are absolutely organized. And of course, to work and succeed within this ecosystem, you need to have great customer service. You know, I was reading a recent indictment, from a ransomware indictment in the US. You know, that's what I do over weekends, you know, read criminal indictments, which you can get access to if you pay a fee to the US court service. And in this ransomware gang, there were three VPs. You know, there was two VP of development, there was a product manager, there was a customer success officer. And, you know, and the scary thing about this gang is they paid 20% more than traditional businesses did for the skill. So now there's one talent, but not just for legitimate purposes, but also for using the same talent for maybe more nefarious purposes. So, as I said, I already talked about this really, you know, these threats, you know, very often the bit that we hear about in the dark web is a little bit sensationalist. It's not really real. You know, it's about, you know, just getting some column inches, but actually in most cases it stings and it's not really the things we should concern about. The bits we should concern ourselves about is the following. The first of all, there is a big emergence right now in an industry where there's really scarce resources, where it's difficult to find good security professionals. Crime as a service has become a thing. It's become a real thing. And actually what happens here is that people that are able to compromise systems, get access to systems, have become a very scarce and really very valuable economy. They've become a very important commodity. And on a lot of the forums, you can actually get access to hackers for hire. And actually, again, as I said previously, these are quite specialist. You'll get hackers that specialize in particular areas. So when you go into one of these deep web forums, you put a job ad, you know, it's literally like a job board, you know, as you would see in the normal world. You know, you take the specific skills you're looking for, a list of candidates will come up, their terms of work, what they will or won't do. For instance, no Russian criminal or hacker will ever hack anything in Russia. It's bad, bad for your life expectancy and for life expectancy of your family. This is like this written code. So they'll say what they will and won't do. You put your ticks in and up comes a list of people that will do your bidding for a fee. And of course, this is again where the escrow comes into, because sometimes, you know, you need to deposit the money, and once the person's delivered what they said they would deliver, the escrow agent will do the payment crosswise. So now let's look at malware. Now, when I talk about malware, malware is not just one thing. You know, we often think about malware as just malware, you know, but actually malware is a number of things. You know, at its very basic, it can be the old-fashioned virus. What's a virus? It's some program that does something unintended, causes some damage or disruption to your local machine, okay? It can also be a backdoor, literally good software that's designed to give somebody access to your system. Now, you know, backdoors could be legitimate software. You know, there's been examples of backdoors in Fortinet, Cisco, Juniper, Palo Alto Networks, firewalls, which given a particular username and password, allow the person full access to the device. So malware could be backdoors. It can be remote access trojans. What's a remote access trojan? It's basically a piece of software that gets onto a machine. It doesn't do anything malicious, but all it does, it allows somebody remote to connect to the machine and take access control of that machine. And remote access trojans are really, really valuable to hackers, because once you develop one that works and is undetectable, you can then use that to get onto machines and sell that access to people. And the people that do sell that access are called initial access brokers. You know, as I said, it's a very specialized ecosystem, but very specific things that they do in a very structured way. You know, malware could be a wiper. A wiper is something that will wipe information or supposed to cause disruption. Example of a wiper, or semi-example of a wiper, is what Americans and Israelis allegedly did at Natanz with the Iranian enrichment, where the software there was used to destroy the actual centrifuges that was enriching the uranium to disrupt the atomic weapons program of the Iranians. So malware is not just one thing. It could be a number of different things, and different different types of malware require different kinds of approaches. The one thing that's important with malware, though, is just there's two things that really is important with malware. The first thing is you need to exploit. Malware generally needs to exploit something within the system in order to be able to run. Okay. And the second thing is malware needs to be delivered. You need to get malware. Malware needs to get into a system. So which brings me on to our next point. The most common way for malware to be developed or delivered is via phishing. Just good old-fashioned phishing. You know, there's an old saying in cybersecurity, and it's a boring saying, but I'm going to share it with you anyway. And the saying goes something like this. If you give somebody a zero-day exploit, you allow them to exploit the system once. If you teach them how to fish, you teach them how to exploit systems forevermore. Phishing is absolutely still the prime way that malware gets delivered. And in the case of ransomware, you know, if we look at the studies, more than 80% of ransomware gets delivered via phishing emails. An email that comes into somebody's inbox, somebody clicks on a link, or there's a piece of software that somebody opens. And surprising amount of stuff is still macros. You know, we did a study within the charity sector, and macros and document macros gets used a lot. And malware, most of the cases of ransomware was based on macros. And it's also tools within the deep web, which will allow you to create these macros in ways that kind of defeats most of the anti-malware packages like the antivirus vendors. So phishing is still a very, very important part of this. Okay. Now let's get into ransomware. Now, ransomware is a very specific form of malware. So malware is malicious. It's not there. It's not doing what you think it's doing. It's not doing what you intended to do. And what's the purpose of malware, of ransomware? Of course, in the early days, it was just encrypt your information, because, you know, if I can't sell you information, it's because it's not valuable to anybody else. Your information certainly is valuable to yourself. So that's one of the early forms of ransomware. Now, there are a couple of interesting things about ransomware, which I just want to touch on, which I'll go into a bit more detail later. First of all, as I said before, there's no honor amongst thieves. There's this belief that sometimes that hacker groups won't target charities, they won't target hospitals, they won't target medical research, and that's not true. You know, because generally ransomware is indiscriminate. After ransomware takes hold, very often the hackers, as I'll give you an example later on, might say, okay, you don't have to pay to get the decryption key, but the damage is done. You still have to have somebody to get the systems back running again. So very often it spreads in indiscriminate fashion, but then afterwards becomes quite targeted. And another thing about ransomware is that there's a lot more repeat attacks than people realize. You know, half of victims who pay the ransom actually get targeted again. And this is not different to what happens with scammers. If somebody knows they can scam somebody for money, the scammers often sell on that victim's detail to somebody else for other scams. So we see a lot of repeat activity with ransomware. So now, of course, ransomware has developed a lot. It started off very simply. Well, let's call it simple, in the sense that it just encrypted data. They then started encrypting backups too. But then the hackers got a bit cleverer. It was indiscriminate initially, but then once they got a remote access Trojan deployed on the machine, they then got onto the machine, maybe deployed some malware there to allow them to get across the network, and started scouting around for information that's embarrassing. This happened to one or two charities where emails were exposed that were really deeply, deeply embarrassing to the charities. The hacker groups will also look for evidence of insurance. They look for the quantum of the insurance to see how much the company's insured for. And then funny enough, very often the ransom is just shy of the insurance value. So it's moved on massively to the point now where that they scout around and they try to cause a maximum embarrassment and try to extract the most amount of money as I can from the victims, depending on who the victim is. So just to talk about the numbers here, you know, the damages are just astronomical. But just to take you back to 2013, you know, one of the first very successful ransomware tools was a thing called CryptoLocker. And within 2 months, CryptoLocker netted the criminals $27 million. I mean, just let's just let that sink in for a second. $27 million in 2 months. And of course, how do we know this? Because one of the real enabling factors for ransomware is cryptocurrencies. Because now, once somebody compromises it or gets some interesting information or wants to share it or threaten to share it, or they need to get payment. And for that to work, for any ransom to work, we all know from watching blockbuster Hollywood movies, you know, you need to have a proper exchange. And cryptocurrencies allows you to do that in a fairly anonymous, very easy, automated fashion, which is why if I now look at the figures, you know, this comes from the Financial Times, you know, ransomware is predicted to have damage of $20 billion with a B, billion dollars by 2021, which is just an astronomical figure. Now, the thing to take away from that is if you have this amount of money coming into the criminal ecosystem, it allows them to hire better people, allows them to get more sophisticated, allows them to get access to the best talent, the best tools. And actually, it now means that this industry is, for the first time since I've been involved, since 1994, actually pays, and it's becoming an industry. So now, I could talk a lot about ransomware, but I want to mention this example because I think there's a few learnings here. What you're looking at here is a bunch of Irish squaddies restoring Windows 7 PCs in the Irish Health Service, HSE. What happened is, you know, they got done with a ransomware attack, you know, and from Conti, the Conti group, managed to get into them. As I said, it's indiscriminate. Conti, not wanting very bad PR for hacker group, provided the decryption keys for free. But still, you needed to install these decryption keys on every single PC within this health service. And this kind of just makes it real, you know, that the effect isn't just about getting your data back. It's also about getting back into production and the effect on people's lives. And when you look at stuff like this, you realize that this actually is a problem that's here to stay. And if I look at that $20 billion going into the system, this thing will not go away anytime soon. So now, just to give you some other stats around this, you know, so there's a couple of fairly worrying numbers here. If I look at the graph on the left, okay, the bars here reflect the number of attacks that happened within each of those quarters. But then the bit that's even more worrying is the average cost of ransom, the average ransom. And you can see this is the red line here. In 2018, it was tiny, you know, it was like $20,000. Whereas now it's between the median figure now is $170,000 for the average ransom that's demanded. So the figures aren't trivial. And of course, here again, this is the insurance premiums on the right. I'm looking at the amount of insurance that insurers are making from ransomware. It's predicted in Europe to be $5.25 billion in 2025. Now, on the right-hand side, this is more interesting for me, is that here we look at the number of brokers, insurance brokers, that see an increase in demand for people to buy insurance against cyber insurance. It's driven by ransomware, but with cyber insurance, it's not ransomware insurance. But at the same time, you also see that they've got a decrease in capacity, which is what's driving the prices up. So insurance for cyber activities, not just ransomware, is becoming increasingly expensive. So what this brings me to now is an interesting point, is that the sad story is that ransomware doesn't just reward the criminals. It rewards insurers, if you think about it. It rewards the companies that create tools against ransomware. So in a way, this is almost one of those problems where it's not in the interest of some people to solve the problem, which is kind of, this is a bit of an interesting thought. But what we've seen recently too, which is really, really worrying, is that a lot of the criminal gangs are starting to target employees with a cut of the profits. Between 20 to 40% of the profits will go to the employee of a successful ransomware attack. Now, if the average ransom is $160,000, I mean, that's anything from $32,000 to close to $70,000, which is not bad going. For all you need to do is take a memory stick or click on a link or install a program on your local machine, and then from there onwards, it spreads. So this is really about saying that actually people make money out of it. And unfortunately, through human nature, where money's involved, sometimes some people will not do the right thing. So now let's just very quickly look at Wheel of Fortune. I'm about 2 minutes away and then I'm finished. So if I look at the money, where does the money come from? Okay, so first of all, you need to follow the money because that tells you what what's important. The first thing is, as I mentioned already, there's this notion of monetizing access to the PC. So once somebody has got an exploit or developed an exploit for vulnerability, got that exploit onto the machine and got access to that machine, this is a very important commodity. And to be clear here, this is not just for the place where the ransomware breaks out, but also for a place where somebody might launch a ransomware attack. So access to PCs, even home PCs, and very often with vulnerabilities against home routers, we found this a lot where people's home devices were compromised and was used to infer the downstream attacks. Okay. Then of course, we talked about the marketplaces, the areas where you can make money from selling tools, you know, malware, ransomware, cryptos that will disguise malware so the virus engines don't pick it up. So forth. Of course, we have the macro tools, which I talked about, which is really the tools that you can use to insert malicious macros into documents or scripts within JavaScript, within PDF documents, and so forth. Okay. And this carries on. And I guess what I'm trying to get to here is that this is a really, really sophisticated ecosystem. It's an ecosystem where there's a lot of money, and it's an ecosystem that's not going away anytime soon with the amount of money that enters into this ecosystem. So now talking about this wheel of fortune and all the bad stuff, you know, I guess in a way, ransomware has just become the perfect cyber weapon. Why has it become the perfect cyber weapon? Because it takes skill, and it uses that skill to do transfer of wealth from good people to people with less good intentions, you know, and it's easy to do. You can automate it. You can scale it. As we've seen from the Financial Times things, you know, the money that made from ransomware is growing on an exponential basis. So it's a perfect weapon. It's a perfect way to monetize skill. And in a way, we've not been able to actually do something about it. It's just getting worse. So, and the question is, why is this getting worse? You know, what's the reason behind it? Okay. I think there's a few reasons. Number one, the tools that we use are sometimes overly complicated, difficult to deploy. I think in order to protect against ransomware, people often say you need to get the basics right, but none of us have enough resources to get everything right. You know, people always talk about patching, all the user education, all these different things, but you have to get those right all the time, and it's not as easy to get right as it is. I think also, you know, prioritization of different things one has to do within limited resources is very, very difficult. You know, what do I prioritize? Do I prioritize user education? Do I prioritize patching? Do I prioritize buying more tools? You know, where should my priorities be in terms of trying to fight against this epidemic? And the key thing to realize here is that ransomware is just a manifestation, a visible manifestation of hacking. It's one that we can track. It's one that we have visibility over because we can look at the ransoms that's demanded. We look at the blockchain to see how much money flew to the different ransomware gangs. But actually, it's just like a small window into this world of cybercrime. So what would I recommend people do? I think, you know, as a technology vendor that's been doing it since 1994, and, you know, I guess I like to think I've got a very pragmatic approach about this. A lot of the focus in our industry is on protection. Buy tools, you know, buy firewalls, IDSs, IPSs, SIEM, anomaly behavior tools, you name it, the tools are there. But not enough time is spent on trying to anticipate the threat, trying to identify when this is happening, detecting it, and mostly responding to the threat after it's happened. So I think it's really, really important that one, in a mature cyber defense strategy, balances across these different areas, not just throw money towards the protection side, but also assume that at some stage there'll be an issue. You need to have the ability to detect it and almost certainly be in a position to respond to it, because what time has shown us and what we know for sure is that if you have a proper incident response plan in place, you greatly diminish the cost, and you reduce the impact of any potential attacks.
So that's it. We really hope you enjoyed this snippet from our recent webinar with Flow Communications, F-Secure and Save the Children. If you want to hear more and listen to the discussion part of the session on how Save the Children deal with over 100,000 attempts of malware infections per month, just head over to our website or YouTube channel for the full webinar. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you'll tune in next time. See ya!